Good morning and welcome to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Paul Lawrence, partner in charge of the IBM Center for the Business of Government. We created the center in 1998 to encourage discussion and research into new approaches to improving government effectiveness. You can visit us on the web and find out more at www.businessofgovernment.org. The Business of Government Radio Hour features a conversation about management with a government executive who is changing the way government does business. Our special guest this morning is David Walker, Comptroller General of the United States and head of the Government Accountability Office. Good morning, David.
Good morning. It's good to be with you again, Paul.
Thank you for joining us. And also joining us in our conversation from IBM is Al Morales. Good morning, Al.
Good morning, Paul.
Well, David, let's start by talking about GAO. Could you tell us the history of the Government Accountability Office, the vision and the mission?
Well, the GAO has been around since 1921. We're a legislative branch agency. We were created at the same time of the Bureau of Budget, which is now called the Office of Management and Budget. And initially, we were called the General Accounting Office, but now we're the Government Accountability Office.
And how do you describe its size in terms of its budget? And I'm even interested in sort of the skill set of the employees.
Well, we have about 3,200 employees, 70% of whom are in Washington, D.C. The balance are in 11 other cities around the United States. Our budget is about $460 million a year. And the skills and knowledge is very diverse. You know, candidly, we probably have about the most diverse array of skills and knowledge of any organization in the world.
What I always find interesting is, who do you report to?
The answer is I report to the Congress, but no one particular individual. As you know, there are 100 members of the Senate, 435 members of the House. We do have an oversight committee in the Senate and the House. In the Senate, it's Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs. And in the House, it's House Government Reform. But there isn't a single person that I report to.
Now, you mentioned in your answer to the last question that GAO has just changed its name. Why was the name changed?
Well, there are a number of reasons. Number one, we were not in the accounting business. We've never been in the accounting business. And so the word accounting was not reflective of who we are and what we did. And it caused confusion with regard to recruiting. It caused confusion with regard to new members of Congress, with regard to, you know, new cabinet-level officials who had never been in Washington before. And so my view was, and it was shared by a vast majority of the people within GAO, is that we needed a name that more accurately reflected who we are and what we do. And we have three core values. Accountability is who we are and what we do. Integrity is how we do it, and reliability is how we want the work to be received. So we went from the General Accounting Office to the Government Accountability Office, which enabled us to maintain our brand acronym, which is GAO.
David, what are the specific roles of the Comptroller General of the GAO?
Well, I'm the Comptroller General of the United States and head of the GAO, and as Comptroller General of the United States, I'm the de facto Chief Accountability Officer of the United States, and obviously the CEO of the Government Accountability Office.
Great. That's a very large responsibility. Can you describe the previous positions and experiences that you had prior to being appointed to the Comptroller General?
Well, I've had about 20 years in the private sector with PricewaterhouseCoopers. That should sound familiar. And also with Arthur Andersen, as well as in consulting with a international consulting and executive search firm. I also have had positions in the executive branch. I was head of the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, Assistant Secretary of Labor for Pensions and Health, and also served as a trustee of Social Security and Medicare while I was with Arthur Andersen. So pretty balanced public and private sector background, more private sector than public. But by the time I get done with this job, it'll be about half and half.
Can you describe to us how the experiences you've had in both the public and private sectors help shape your current role?
Well, I think there's no question that my experiences both from the public and the private sector have helped me to be more effective in my current job. You know, there are a lot of transferable knowledge and skills that you can get between sectors, but there are some important differences between the sectors, too. One of the things that I know that when my position was open and when I was competing with about 59 other people for appointment, that there were a lot of people who were involved in the appointment process who really wanted somebody who had both public and private sector experience, who had a proven track record of success in both sectors, recognizing that you need new ideas, you need people who are coming in from the outside who can challenge the status quo. At the same point in time, you needed people who understood government and that there were different cultures and there were, you know, very important differences between the public and private sector that you need to be aware of in order to be effective. For example, in the public sector, you have many more bosses. You have a lot more constraints on what you can do. You live in a fishbowl. And generally, a lot of the top executives, especially in the executive branch, don't stay in their jobs very long. And so it's actually much more challenging to be successful in the public sector than it is the private sector. But that's a real opportunity as well.
You're nearly halfway through a 15-year term. Why does this position carry such a long term, and what are some of the challenges with this type of assignment?
Well, my term is the longest of any position in the federal government that has a term. Second place is the Federal Reserve Board. Third place is the director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the FBI. And the reason being is because the idea is that you want to have at least one person in government who has a long enough term that you can think long term and take on complex and controversial issues that may take years to effectively address. And so that's the reason for the 15-year term. But I think you have to couple that with the fact that the Comptroller General of the United States can only be removed by impeachment for specified reasons. And so, therefore, once you're in, it's very difficult to be removed. That provides you a degree of job security to be able to speak truth to power, tell it like it is, say what you mean what you say, etc.
I know our audience would be interested in terms of the other changes you've been making at GAO besides the name. I think you've been involved in a lot of transformation in a relatively short period of time. Could you tell us about some of the changes that have been taking place since you took over?
Well, GAO has always been a great agency. It's always had great people, and it's had strong and effective leadership. But one of the things that I found when I came to GAO is that it itself needed to engage in a fundamental transformation of what it did and how it did business. And I gained agreement among our top executives early on in my tenure to a very simple concept, leading by example. Since we're the agency that audits, investigates, evaluates others, my view is that we should be as good or better than anybody else that we audit, investigate, or evaluate. We should practice what we preach. And as a result, our people have rallied to that, such that we are recognized externally by others as being the best or among the best in strategic planning, organizational alignment, human capital strategy, financial management, information technology, change management, knowledge management, which helps us do a better job but also enhances our credibility.
This sounds like pretty radical change. Maybe you could take us through a couple steps. I'm wondering sort of how you got everybody there, because getting people on the same page for change is the first step. And then whether many of the same people continued with you or you had to make some changes in people as well.
Well, first, obviously, to the extent that you make significant changes, you have to be able to make a compelling case for change. You have to convince people that the status quo is inappropriate, unacceptable, unsustainable, whatever is the case. And that's a challenge, but it's something that needs to be done. It's especially challenging when you talk about an organization that doesn't change that much, and an industry, government, that by definition is fairly rule-bound. Fortunately, I was able to make that case as to why we needed to make changes and why it was in everybody's interest to be able to do that. But as you know, whether you're in the public sector, private sector, not-for-profit sector, you have to start at the top and you start with the new people. And so as a result, gained agreement of the executives. And during the last 6 years since I've been at GAO, we've hired a lot of new people. In fact, over 40% of the people who work at GAO today have come to work since I've been Comptroller General of the United States. So by starting at the top and starting with the new people and working to the middle, you can end up achieving a lot in a fairly short period of time.
Now, I remember once you told me this, Matt, so if I don't get it right, it's from my recollection, that prior to your arrival, GAO's budget and the headcount had been either reduced or was flat. Could you tell us what's changed in that area?
In the 5 years before I joined GAO, the agency was downsized 40%, and it had a virtual hiring freeze for about 5 years. So at the time that I joined, less than 5% of the employees had been with the agency for less than 5 years. And so therefore that was a challenge from a variety of different reasons. We had a development gap in the pipeline. We had succession planning challenges. We had a variety of skills imbalances, et cetera. And so we took that very seriously and took it on to be able to deal with it. I'm pleased to say that since I've been at the GAO, the Congress has, I think, treated us well. I think they've treated us as well or better than others. And what I've tried to do is to make sure that we have modest budget requests, that we don't try to build up the base and try to just ask for what we think we need. Don't play games on the budget and generate a very, very strong rate of return or return on investment. Last year, our return on investment was $95 to 1, an all-time record, number one in the world. Nobody's even close.
How did you engage the Congress of the United States? In a previous answer, you told us there's 535 individuals. I mean, how did you do that?
Well, you obviously have to be able to respect the views of every single member of Congress, no matter how long they've been there and whether or not they're a freshman or, you know, where they're from and what committees they're on. At the same point in time, you spend a disproportionate amount of time with the leadership of the Congress and the chair and ranking members of various committees, in particular the committees that are our oversight committees, the ones that I mentioned before. So one has to end up allocating your time strategically, and that's what I've tried to do.
It's interesting, especially when you think about your comment earlier about not having a boss. What are the challenges of the 21st century, and what do they mean for citizens and government? We'll ask David Walker of the GAO to take us through this when our conversation about management continues on the Business of Government Hour.